Welcome to Behind the Lore, your behind-the-scenes look into the research that it takes to make each episode of Lore Podcast. I'm Allie Steed, and today I'm sitting down with a very special guest to record one of my episodes, number 235, Privilege. In this episode, I'm exploring the origins of the Reformation, Ireland's fairy problem, and how the more things change, the more they stay the same. Your support keeps us going, so once again, we're thrilled to have you here with us. Please join us for a new episode of Behind the Lore. Hi everybody, welcome back to Behind the Lore. Today we are doing something a little different because this is actually one of my episodes. Now normally what happens when one of my episodes comes up is that Aaron is my interviewee, but today we've got a very special guest from our, I guess it's kind of a sister show, right, Harry? You are doing Behind the Lore Legends. I am doing Behind the Lore. So we're having a head-to-head host, well, not quite battle, but you know.
It's going to turn into an epic rap battle pretty soon.
I don't have the most amount of faith in myself for that, but you know, you go, girl.
I'm going to spit some fierce rhymes.
Oh, I'll bet. I'll take some fierce questions instead, though. I'm really excited about this. I haven't gotten to do an episode in so long, and like, I love doing the interviews and everything, but there's something really special when it's one of yours.
Oh, absolutely. I'm looking forward to when my episode of Lore Legends comes up, you interviewing me, so yeah. That'll be fun.
Yeah, we'll flip the script. It'll be great.
Definitely. All right, so shall we dive in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Excellent. All right, so this is about the latest episode of Lore, about Alice Keitler. And what I'm going to start off with is really just a general question about Ireland and the witch trials, because, you know, when we often think of Ireland, or when most people think of Ireland, they don't really think about the witch trials. That's really saved for Salem, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. But Ireland had been going through witch trials, or had been having them for hundreds of years, where Salem, really, their trials only lasted about a year. So why is it that Ireland has sort of fallen to the back burner when we think of these witch trials that have gone on for so long?
So the thing you kind of have to understand, we've done a ton of European witch trials on this show. When it comes to Writer's Room, I have to scrounge to find a trial that we haven't done yet. And I stumbled on Alice Keitler, and I looked at her story before and I was wholly convinced that we must have done it, because like, it's such a good story. We have to have done it. And we just didn't. And I started digging more and more when I started getting into the research for the episode. Technically, Ireland had trials for a few hundred years, but they were very much in line with a lot more of the trials that were happening later on in the American colonies, in that they were sparse and they were one-offs. They weren't like Salem or like a lot of European trials during the height of the panic between like the mid-1400s and the early 1700s, where dozens of people in a town were getting confused. It was usually elderly women, and there were pretty high death tolls, and they would spread from town to town to town. Ireland's trials were one-offs. They didn't happen very often. Usually it was one person being accused, and they didn't always end in execution, as was the case with Alice, although that was more because she legged it and not because they weren't perfectly willing to kill her, because at that point they definitely were, and everything that happened to her poor maid, I mean. And there's also this really interesting environment where these trials are happening, in that there was a lot of folklore around magical creatures like fairies, whereas they're kind of the antagonist in these stories. In other parts of Europe and later in the American colonies, that's the part that the witch would take. Like, they are destroying the crops and dealing with this, that, and the other thing. The thing is, you can't capture a fairy, or, well, nobody ever successfully did. So there are these things you can do, like knocking on wood or turning around three times and spitting to try to keep them away. But with a witch, you have an actual thing you can do to a real person. You can put them on trial. You can hope that it does something and move on with your life. But in a place where fairies are your main antagonist, well, you do what you can. And then there's the religious aspect, of course.
Do you think the witches then were surrogates for the fairies they couldn't get their hands on?
I don't know if it's a case of surrogacy. I'm not saying that the concept of witches didn't exist, because it definitely did. But I think fairies were just more common. They're two completely different things in people's minds, but they're both equally bad. One is just less common than the other.
Okay. I'm gonna skip around a little bit. Going back to what you said about how the trials in Ireland were sort of few and far between, they were one-offs, it seemed that the Irish weren't as worried about witches living amongst them until the English arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Even the punishments in Ireland for being a witch were much less severe than what the English brought with them, which was torture and murder and burnings and all of that. So why weren't they as scared of the witches versus the English?
So as far as I can tell from my research, it's kind of like lighting a candle using the same match. So witch trials exist in Ireland and they exist in Europe for decades, if not centuries, before the height of the trials occurs around the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, around the period of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. It isn't until you see this explosion of trials in Reformation territories that it starts to kind of kick off in other places. So you have these Germanic territories that are going through intense religious, social, economic upheaval. They're looking for somebody to blame, and they land on witches, which is partially because of the culture that existed, partially because of the religions that were fighting. And partially, people just either looking to settle a grudge or make some money or both. So those start in Germanic territories, and they spread to England, and we've covered this in other episodes, through people like James the First, who was James the Sixth of Scotland. We've talked about him in the North Berwick Trials. We've talked about him in so many other episodes. He picks up a lot of these concepts about the dangers which is posed specifically to monarchs, because he's nothing if not self-centered. And the best ways to hunt them and torture them and execute them from his wife, who, if I'm remembering rightly, was Danish. But she came from an area where there were very heavy witch trials. He spent some time there when he went to go pick her up. There is the very famous storm, which convinces him that witches are out to get James in particular. And so he goes back to Scotland with this newfound knowledge and a thirst for blood, and pretty much immediately starts witch trials. In England, there were witches, but they were much less of a concern. Henry kind of kickstarts this little bit of paranoia when he breaks from the Catholic Church, because now these once religious crimes, like witchcraft, are no longer governed by the church. They're governed by the state. People who run the state can be pretty petty. I'm not saying the church officials weren't, because they definitely were. They had their jealousies, they had their issues, but usually it was a third party coming into these situations that had really no stake in it. So you were a lot less likely to get the severe punishments. So Henry has to create his own law about witchcraft. And it's not super violent. It's from 1543, and I'm not going to read the whole thing for you. I think I put the entire text of every English law about witches until James the First, and then the entire text of all the Irish ones in the research. So sorry, Aaron, that was my bad. So when Henry creates this law, Elizabeth makes it a little stronger, because she's worried about threats to her throne, but that's coming from the Catholics, not the witches. So she kind of leaves it alone, but then she dies and she has no direct Tudor heir, so the Stuarts take power through James. And James brings that match with him from Scotland to England and kickstarts a whole new culture of witch hunts. So how does this relate to Ireland? England conquered parts of Ireland during the Middle Ages, way back when. And then England decided they had other problems, so they weren't as involved in that administration as they would have liked to have been. Henry VIII kind of changed all that and refocused attention on Ireland. So right when the fear of witches starts picking up in England again and more English colonists are going to Ireland, more attention is being paid to that colony. When James takes over, it's all over. Like, witches abound. They're everywhere in England. So the fear kind of gets planted early, back during the original occupation. But it grows and it grows and it grows. And Alice's story takes place years before Henry is ever on the throne. But you can kind of see the English hand in it all the way down through.
So I have two questions. And the first question is, when we think of, or now that we have been analyzing the Salem witch trials for hundreds of years, we have seen that behind them, not all of the trials, but a good portion of them, there was a clear thread of subjugation of women and wresting land away from people so that other people could get that land. And so the trials were sort of seen as a way to get them out of the way. Was there that kind of thing going on in England and Ireland at the time, or was this really just a matter of fear among the people?
It's interesting because Salem is such, it's almost like a time capsule. It was so unique for the American colonies that it has been incredibly well preserved. I have torn my hair out over some European trials that don't have half the documentation, but were twice as bloody as Salem, which, you know, sometimes it's like comparing apples to oranges, but it should be said that the legal system that existed in the American colonies was the British legal system, which means that some British laws also applied in the American colonies. And that law of property is kind of a weird sticking point. I don't know all of the details of how it was enforced in English trials. I do know that when you went into prison, you had to pay for yourself. You know, we make jokes about 3 square meals a day and medical care with our prisons now, but that was not a guarantee. You had to pay for your food. You had to pay for any clothing you got. You had to pay for your medical care, if you got any, and, you know, most poor people were not getting any. And if you were a rich person locked up in the Tower, that wasn't really a problem. Like, when Sir Walter Raleigh gets arrested, he has really nice rooms. He has really nice stuff. He has his books. He gets visits from his wife. He's, you know, he can't leave, but as far as prisons go, it's pretty cushy, which is not something you hear very often about the Tower of London, but...
No, definitely not. The Tower of Denmark, maybe, but not the Tower of London.
But for poor people who have no money going in, it is up to their families to settle those debts. And if they can't settle the debts, property starts getting confiscated. And it's possible that their family could end up in debtor's prison. It was this whole cycle that was truly horrendous. So it's not a stretch to think that in European trials and in English trials in particular, people who were going into these prisons, if they made it out, lost a lot or even lost everything. Now, the pamphlets that are talking up how great these trials are don't usually go into the fact that, Jeanette Devine came into prison with this many cows and a house with this many rooms and this many bottles and a kettle and a cat. And when she came out, she only had the cat. It's just not as exciting. It's not very sexy. So,
right.
If you want to go through and dig through the financial records, I'm quite confident you can find people who had to pay off their jailer before they could be let out of jail.
Okay. It's so funny how this piece of American history, the Salem Witch Trials, have such a lingering presence in our minds and on our the map of our country. And it was a year. I had written a cabinet story about the Pony Express, which ran from about April of 1860 until October of 1861. It was about a year and a half of the Pony Express. And yet it is an iconic piece of Americana and American history. And it was a blip on the radar.
It always seems like it lasts so much longer than it does.
Right.
And that honestly makes me curious because as Americans, I think all of our researchers were born in America, we're at the very least educated here. I at least tend to view witch trials kind of through the Salem lens of like, oh, how does this compare to Salem? What was it like? Like those right. comparisons are really interesting to me. So I'm kind of curious for our listeners who are coming from elsewhere, like how much... I recognize that witch trials do not have the same amount of impact on other people as they do on us, but
yeah,
what do you know about Salem? How much do you think about it beyond the season of Unobscured that we did and a few episodes here and there? Like I'm really curious.
Right, or whenever you watch Hocus Pocus.
Oh yeah, annual tradition. We are coming up on spooky season. I will be watching it once a week.
If you're Starbucks, it already is spooky season because the pumpkin spice is out in force.
Oh, I saw this morning at a very empty Target.
My other question, just going back, you had mentioned the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
This period in history, can you just briefly explain what it was and why it made such a fertile environment for these trials to take off? And I think you did, to a degree, go into that.
Oh,
but,
totally.
I'm curious about just... What exactly was the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation during this period?
Yeah, I'm happy to get more specific. I can go on about this for ages.
We have 15 minutes. So.
I have to look up the dates real quick because I am not good with dates. So for me, honestly, the Reformation is like the boogeyman of the witch trials. It is a really interesting thought experiment for me of... What would have happened if the Reformation didn't exist? Not religiously, because that's a whole other kettle of fish that I'm sure philosophers can devote decades to, but with witch trials, because witch trials happened in Europe throughout the centuries, but I'm honestly curious if they would have continued on in that pattern of one man or one woman getting accused maybe once a decade, if that, or if it would have expanded to something else, because, you know, it becomes this whole big thing. Rich people can get away with whatever they want. That was true then.
Nothing changes.
That is true now. Kings, aristocrats, knights, people with a lot of money were doing a lot of really shady things, and the church let them do it because the church really liked money. The Catholic Church, which is what I'm referring to when I say the church, was a very wealthy institution and had a lot of spiritual power over the monarchs, the aristocrats, a lot of people. Now, at one point, this wasn't an absolute power, and some of you are going to be shocked to hear this, but Christianity at one point was a pacifist religion. Unfortunately, Christianity became the state religion of an empire that was not pacifist. Rome was not interested in pacifism. They were interested in conquest. So Christianity really lost a lot of its kind of core values. There was not a lot of practice what you preach with Roman emperors and Christianity. But that didn't really matter because there were secular authorities and there were religious authorities. And never the twain shall meet, except they did. The Catholic Church ends up gaining a huge amount of political power in a lot of European countries. So they solidify this power through a couple of things. They create the concept of holy war, during the First Crusade in, I think, 1099, Pope Urban II puts the canon lawyers on it and says, give me a reason to send all of these wealthy, violent people after somebody so I can keep control over them, because he was worried about the papacy losing power to secular monarchs. The other thing was something called indulgences. Now, indulgences are pretty much exactly what they sound like. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card. You can do something so heinous, it is basically guaranteed to get you excommunicated. But if you have enough money, you can go to your local priest, bishop, cardinal, or even the Pope if you did something bad enough. And let's be frank, a lot of these nobles were doing some really bad things. And you could make a donation. You could fix up the abbey. You could get more stained glass. You could do a lot of things. Basically, you were giving money in exchange for a get-out-of-jail-free card, and your sin was wiped away. Now, for a long time, people had a lot of issues with this. The corruption within the Catholic Church was not a secret. People knew, people weren't happy, and people wanted to do something about it. But if you have an institution that has a lot of money and has a lot of power and has a lot of violent friends, it's kind of hard to get something going. But that did not stop a man named Martin Luther. So Martin Luther was a German priest, a theologian. He was a very smart guy, and he was Catholic. He was a member of the Catholic Church. He was a priest. So the Reformation is considered to have started in 1517 when Martin Luther nails the 95 Theses to a church door, which is basically a list of all the crappy things the Catholic Church is doing. And the Catholic Church says, hey, we recognize that this is a problem. We wish you had not handled this so publicly. Get that shit off the door, or we're going to excommunicate you. And Martin Luther said, bet. And he got excommunicated in 1521 and basically starts this huge conversation, which leads to entire cities, entire countries. The concept of a nation state did not exist at that point, but you get what I'm saying. Breaking off from the Catholic Church. And they kind of create their own churches in protest. They create Protestant, Protestant churches where they have a different religious structure. They have different goals. They have different interpretations of some scriptures. And you end up with all these different sects. And the Catholic Church responds by saying, okay, well, we're going to fix some things. And they launch their own counter-reformation. Now, I would argue that neither of these movements were particularly successful because the Reformation wanted the Catholic Church to fix itself, and they didn't. So they wanted to leave and basically get everyone away from the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church wanted to bring everybody back to Catholicism. So neither of those two things worked. What they did create was a war zone. They created a ton of upheaval in a lot of places, particularly the Holy Roman Empire, tons of Germanic territories, and eventually in England when they launched their own Reformation. And at this point, stability is not really something that people can rely on. So they're scared. There's people fighting and dying. There's famine. There's disease. There's all these issues, and they're looking for someone to blame. Technically, you can blame generations of Catholic popes, but you can't do anything to generations of Catholic popes. But what you can do is get real pissy with the beggar woman from down the block who asked for a little more than she usually does. And things kind of spiral from there.
Well, she knows what she did.
A lot of times she didn't, but, you know, some nice torture will clue anyone into the situation.
And that's how famed hammer enthusiast Martin Luther celebrated the first Festivus, by the airing of the grievances.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. But yeah, so a lot of these big, deadly trials happened during this period, but they could be plenty violent before. What we saw with poor Alice's maid. Privilege, to me, was such an interesting title for this episode, because if Alice hadn't had the money she did and the connection she did, mm-hmm. she absolutely would have been right there next to Petronilla and probably been executed. We have no idea what happened to Alice, but we have a very gruesome idea of what happened to Petronilla. And without that money, Alice would have been probably just another of the thousands of victims that her name is somewhat remembered, but not like this.
Yeah. It's amazing how the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Oh, totally.
Well, Allie, thank you so much for talking today with me about all of this. This is like a fascinating history lesson. And
good, I'm glad.
I can't wait to talk to you about my episode of Lore Legends now.
Oh, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. Yeah, everybody, thank you for listening to me rant for a half an hour about the Catholic Church. I grew up Catholic. Can anybody tell? I have thoughts.
You only have minor trauma.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Allie.
And thank you.
Until next time.
We're out of here. And that does it for today's episode of Behind the Lore. Many thanks to Harry for chatting with me today. A lot of folks don't know this, but Lore is actually part of a larger network of shows called Grim and Mild, and you can learn more about that and everything else going on over at one central place, grimandmild.com. On behalf of the entire Lore team, thank you for your constant and generous support and for letting us tell you our stories. And until next time, thanks for listening.